Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 23rd of May, these are our main stories. Political drama in Washington as President Trump cut short a meeting with the Democrats.
I told Senator Schumer, Speaker Pelosi, get these phony investigations over with.
I pray for the President of the United States, and I pray for the United States of America.
Scientists now understand what caused a mysterious increase in a chemical that destroys ozone in the atmosphere. Also in this podcast, Britain defiant after the UN General Assembly overwhelmingly supports a resolution demanding it return control of the Chagos Islands to Mauritius. And why this is the latest weapon in the US-China trade war. Let's start in Washington, where there's been political drama at a meeting between President Donald Trump and senior Democrats. They'd met at the White House to talk about an infrastructure building program, but the president ended the meeting after just a few minutes and went outside to address the media.
I walked into the room and I told Senator Schumer, Speaker Pelosi, I want to do infrastructure. I want to do it more than you want to do it. I'd be really good at that. That's what I do. But you know what? You can't do it under these circumstances. So get these phony investigations over with.
Later, the Democratic Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, gave her own account of what had happened, her view being that Mr. Trump had balked the offer of a deal.
For some reason, maybe it was lack of confidence on his part, that he really couldn't match the greatness of the challenge that we have, wasn't really respectful of the reason of the Congress and the White House working together. He just took a pass, and it just makes me wonder why he did that. In any event, I pray for the President of the United States, and I pray for the United States of America.
Our correspondent in Washington, Gary O'Donoghue, gave me his assessment of what was clearly an ill-tempered meeting.
Apparently, I mean, it lasted just a handful of minutes, this meeting. We're told that the president didn't shake hands, didn't sit down, was fuming, really. And it seems the thing that tipped him over the edge was Nancy Pelosi in a press conference earlier on having accused him of being and conducting a cover-up. Now, this is all in relation, of course, to obstruction of justice and the accusations around that in the Mueller investigation. And, of course, in this town, that phrase cover-up has all sorts of resonances that goes back to Richard Nixon, to Watergate. And indeed, at an event later on, Nancy Pelosi said, you know, sometimes the cover-up is worse than the crime. And that's the sort of motif in American politics that really does bring back the whole Watergate thing.
There's also been talk today about the president committing an impeachable offence. What's that all about?
Well, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things related to what happened during the Mueller investigation, particularly around what he asked and didn't ask the White House counsel Don McGahn to do. There's also him standing in the way of these subpoenas from Congress and preventing Congress from doing its whole oversight job. And that's why you're seeing a lot of these committees going to court. In some cases, they're getting some success. They did on Monday. One committee got some success in the courts on Monday. But that's why there's also this huge pressure among some Democrats, particularly the new people in Congress, to bring impeachment proceedings, because they believe that is a way of getting more information formally out of the White House, which in a sense they're refusing to do at the moment. But as things stand, there's a standoff on that, and now there's a standoff on the one thing that Capitol Hill and the White House might have been able to work on together, and that's the infrastructure program.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. Now to a dispute that began in 1965 when Britain used negotiations with its former colony Mauritius to take control of the strategic Chagos Islands in the Indian Ocean. The entire civilian population was evicted, and Britain then invited the United States to set up a joint military base on the largest of the islands, Diego Garcia. But the UN General Assembly has now ruled the British action was unlawful and demanded it return control to Mauritius within the next 6 months. I asked our correspondent Neda Torfik whether today's vote will be seen as an overwhelming diplomatic defeat for Britain.
Absolutely. 116 countries voting alongside Mauritius to pass that resolution, which it is really a diplomatic blow to the United Kingdom, especially at a time when they're trying to show that they still have a diplomatic weight on the international stage after Brexit. Now, what the UK has said is that they regret this resolution, but that they don't feel that it's basically correct in its assessment. So the UK says, you know, this isn't legally binding. They have no plans to follow through with it. But they also say that this issue is a bilateral sovereignty dispute. It has nothing to do with colonialism. And so the UK ambassador to the UN, Ambassador Karen Pearce, said that the UK would stand by their commitment to cede the territory back to Mauritius when there was no longer a need for defense purposes there on the islands. But she said, again, they do not concede that Mauritius has any claim over the islands.
And is this one of the last colonial questions, for want of a better phrase, that's still outstanding, that needs this kind of resolution?
Well, I think that's what 116 countries were saying today in the General Assembly, who sided with Mauritius. You have the likes of Seychelles, for example, who said, you know, when we gained independence, territory formerly administered by the UK was returned to us. And it would stand to reason that the same precedent should be applied to the case of Mauritius. That's also, of course, what the International Court of Justice said in February, and which is why Mauritius brought this issue back to the General Assembly, saying that international law was on their side. Now, Mauritius has said that the forcible eviction of the Chagosians was basically a crime against humanity. And the UK Ambassador Karen Pearce really hit back at that, saying that was a gross mischaracterization. So it's interesting to see how this debate has played out at the UN. But clearly, as we saw here, the overwhelming majority of countries do believe that the UK should give back the territory to Mauritius.
Neda Torfik in New York. Now, the rise of nationalist Eurosceptic parties is keeping the EU establishment awake at night on the eve of the European elections, which start on Thursday. It's one of the biggest electorates on earth, with more than 500 million citizens from 28 EU countries voting over 4 days to choose 751 MEPs. Let's hear from some of those countries involved. Hungary and Austria on the way. First, the Netherlands, found a member of the European project, of course. Now, the last time elections took place in 2014, there was a turnout of just under 40% in the Netherlands. Our correspondent there is Anna Holligan.
I'm standing underneath one of the billboards that's gone up right across the country, featuring posters for the 26 parties that are competing in these elections. Phrases like Jesus yes, EU no, Brussels is not the boss, and Nexit. And of course, that's not necessarily the way the majority of Dutch people feel about the EU, but it does give you a flavour of the debate here. And, you know, the European elections here in the Netherlands generally don't ignite that much excitement among most people. Generally, the turnout's around 37%. But actually, this year, it's really captured the public imagination. And that's partly because of one of the people who is literally the poster boy. He's the new kid on the block in Dutch politics. His name is Thierry Baudet. He is a populist, nationalist politician. He's seen as the new face of the far right here in the Netherlands. And tonight, he will be going head-to-head in a debate against the Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, which just goes to show how seriously the Prime Minister is taking this new competition. According to the latest polls, they are about neck and neck, these two parties. So the VVD, the Liberal Party of the Prime Minister, and the Forum for the Democracy, the Nationalist Party of Thierry Baudet.
And is it your sense that people might be feeling energised because the EU, an organisation that there is affection for in the Netherlands, feels a bit under threat?
There is definitely a sense on both sides that there is a chance now to come out and fight for what they believe in. And I think Brexit has played a big role in that.
So from Anna Holligan in the Netherlands to Hungary and our correspondent Nick Thorpe. Nick, in Hungary, I understand migration has been a big feature of the election campaign.
That's right. Certainly from the governing Fidesz party, that's been their central message, really. Their posters are all about migration, immigration. They say we should send the message to Brussels that immigration can be stopped. That's a little strange when one considers that to Hungary, at least, very little immigration takes place. And most of what does take place is actually of Chinese people fully legally. But they're also talking here. What the government's message, I suppose, is above all is a sovereign message, taking back control from Brussels. And they're saying that control over migration policy, irregular migration and immigration should be taken back from Brussels and handed back to the sovereign nation, specifically to the interior ministers of EU member countries.
Nick Thorpe, thank you. Let's talk to Bethany Bell now, our correspondent in Austria. And Bethany, these EU elections come right in the middle of a political crisis in Austria.
Yes, a bit overshadowed by the fact that the coalition between the Conservative People's Party and the far-right Freedom Party has just collapsed, and fresh elections have been called for September, all in the wake of the revelation of a video involving the head of the far-right Freedom Party, where he was shown in a video sting talking to a woman posing as the niece of a Russian oligarch, and he's promising big public contracts to her. And it was interesting, yesterday Austria's president came out and urged Austrians to come out and vote in the EU elections, not to be put off by politicians, because he said they're not all like that and it's important to get out and vote. He was worried that many Austrians will look at the debacle of the coalition, and he was saying, you know, we mustn't come away with the idea that all politicians are corrupt, that it is important to go out and vote in the EU elections, and we'll have to wait and see exactly how things pan out for the different parties. We haven't had any very meaningful polls since the government collapsed, but certainly the Freedom Party is likely not to do as well as it had once expected to. And then the question will be how Chancellor Sebastian Kurz's Conservatives do, because although they're still in government now with technocrats, there is the shadow of a vote of no confidence hanging over him the day after the EU elections. So we shall see.
Bethany Bell with me from Vienna. An Iranian singer is reported to have been summoned to appear in court after posting a video of herself performing in a traditional costume to a group of tourists. The story from Sebastian Usher.
Negar Muazzam was singing last week for a small group of tourists in an ancient village in the province of Isfahan. She was wearing traditional village dress with a bright red floral head covering that revealed her blonde hair. She had regularly posted videos of her performances before, but this time it seems to have brought unexpected trouble. She's reported to have been ordered to appear before a court after attracting the attentions of a local cultural organisation, which saw her singing solos as against Iran's strict interpretation of Islam. Local tourism officials have also been summoned. The move has prompted anger online, with some Iranians asking why the country wishes to ban happiness.
In the 1980s, a gaping hole in the ozone layer was discovered over Antarctica. Because of their environmental impact, chlorofluorocarbons, or CFC, were supposed to have been phased out under the Montreal Protocol. Now researchers say they pinpointed the major sources of a mysterious rise in emissions of them in eastern China. I found out more from our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath.
Well, scientists have known for a number of years that CFCs were being produced in some form in China. These are chemicals that were banned back in the 1980s, basically, because we found out they were making the hole in the ozone layer much worse. That's the protective layer that protects you and I and animals everywhere from getting skin cancers and things like that. These chemicals were banned, but in 2012, scientists started to pick up signals in the atmosphere that there was continuing production going on. And they found, basically, that they're being continued to be produced in China. And this new report comes out today confirms that particular view.
So what happens now? What sanction can be taken when it's not supposed to be happening and it's been proven that it is?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question, because everybody says they should be banned, and they are banned in most places. The question is how strong people will take action against China in this particular instance. And I don't know that there's a great deal of appetite for doing that. In the UN, they're looking at the problems of the globe and they're seeing climate change, carbon dioxide as the big problem. Who's the biggest emitter on the planet? China. Do they want to go to war with China, put sanctions on China, if you like, over something else like CFCs? when they need China's cooperation on CO2. I think the likelihood is China will crack down on some rogue manufacturers. They've already started to do that. And the world will say, OK, that's fair enough for now.
And in terms of the impact that this has on accelerating climate change, which is what the concern is here, do we know how significant that is?
Yes, the researchers have been looking at that quite clearly. And they know that the use of CFCs can make the hole in the ozone layer worse and could stop the healing that's been going on over the last number of years. But they're also concerned about this impact on climate change. Every ton of this particular CFC-11 is the equivalent of 5,000 tons of CO2. So they reckon that the emissions that have come out every year of these hidden emissions are the equivalent of 35 million tons of carbon dioxide, which is essentially the size of London producing emissions every year. So it's considerable. If these could be stopped and put back, it would have a somewhat helpful restriction on climate change going forward.
Our environment correspondent, Matt McGraw. Still to come in this podcast, the dangers facing young women in Uganda who leave home to find jobs as domestic workers. Here in Britain, the calls for the Prime Minister Theresa May to stand down continue to grow louder. Another cabinet minister resigned on Wednesday. Several more have told the BBC she can't go on. The political standoff has prompted some commentators to talk of the Prime Minister being barricaded inside Downing Street or clinging on to power, as our political correspondent Rob Watson told me.
Yes, and there are all sorts of images on social media of her being in a sort of bunker and nobody being able to get her out, and on the edge of a cliff, or depicted as a sort of robot who's only going to go when the battery runs out. I mean, I think they all add up to the same thing, and that's a portrayal of someone who's obviously immensely, you can choose your adjective, you know, resilient, stubborn, whatever. But here, to sort of strip away from it all, Andrew, look, the game is up. Theresa May's prime ministership is over. Power has ebbed away. Her authority has completely ebbed away. I mean, there is a sort of a small question of, is it hours, is it days? But the game is up. I mean, her time is finished. And actually, the much bigger question will very, very soon become, OK, who replaces her? And what does he or she do, given that they're going to be faced with exactly the same crisis and set of political circumstances?
And, I mean, this has been building for a while. In fact, Theresa May has said that she will stand down in the coming months already. So what changed in the last 24 hours?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. But big picture terms, we already knew that she was resigning, and we weren't sure whether it would be weeks, days or months, but we knew she was certainly going sooner rather than later. I think what's changed is her attempt to get this her withdrawal bill through Parliament. And I think what it's done is that it's, you know, it's alienated both those on the pro-Brexit wing of her party, but also those that she was trying to woo over, her sort of softer Brexiteers or even Remainers in the opposition Labour benches. But I think something that's happened to her, which I guess happens to all politicians, they just reach a moment, it's hard to define, where people just stop listening to them. People just, whether they're making good arguments or bad arguments, everything's just drained away. And I think in Theresa May's case, it's a combination of people being fed up with the kind of leader that she is, the kind of person that she is, but also the way she's handled Brexit.
Our correspondent Rob Watson. Now to Ukraine, where the country's new president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is facing criticism for some of the appointments he's been making to his senior team, including his choice of chief of staff, who's the personal lawyer of a wealthy businessman with connections to Mr. Zelensky. From Kiev, here's Jonah Fisher.
Throughout the election campaign, critics of Volodymyr Zelensky said he was simply a puppet of the oligarch Igor Kolomoisky. Last week, despite being the subject of numerous investigations, Mr. Kolomoisky returned to Ukraine after 2 years of self-imposed exile. Now, in one of the first moves of the new Zelensky administration, Mr. Kolomoisky's former lawyer, Andriy Bogdan, has been given a key position, chief of staff. Having promised to tackle corruption and the power of Ukraine's oligarchs, President Zelensky's willingness to deliver is already being questioned.
Jonah Fisher in Kiev. In Uganda, young women desperate for work are leaving their homes to try to find jobs as domestic workers. For some, though, their new lives can lead to mistreatment and abuse. A charity in Kenya is calling for the introduction of laws to protect domestic workers, commonly referred to as house girls, to try to ensure their safety. Our correspondent Nancy Kachungira has been to investigate.
In eastern Uganda, close to the border, villages supply many of neighbouring Kenya's domestic workers. They're mostly women, many young girls, commonly referred to as house girls. It's here that I first meet Esther, who's 21, and plans to leave her Ugandan border village for Kenya's capital, Nairobi, to find work as a housemaid.
There are jobs here, but the pay is so little. You know, here they just give you $8 per month. That money isn't enough. We go there because we get better money. I can stay here from morning to evening and still see no hope. So I've decided to go.
But Esther is not the only one with this plan. All along the border, young girls from Ugandan villages are leaving their homes in search of better opportunities. Euphrasia Juma sent her 17-year-old orphaned granddaughter Scovia to Nairobi 2 months ago to find work.
When she didn't have the money for her schooling, life was bad. She wanted to study, but I had nothing. She asked, what should she do? I said, go work. Get money and go back to school.
Euphrasia has been worried. Scovia had never even left the village before moving to Kenya. But money made in Nairobi can go a long way here, thanks to the strength of the Kenyan shilling against the Ugandan currency. On arrival in Nairobi, the girls have to find accommodation in the city's informal settlements, the only places they can afford to live. This is where I meet 21-year-old Esther again. She's made the move across the border and is now going door to door looking for work. To keep costs down, Esther splits the $15 a month rent for a small corrugated iron shack that she shares with three other young Ugandans. They have no electricity and share a single mattress.
I will walk around and search. When I get to a house, I will ask if they need over-house help.
The influx of girls from Uganda is causing tensions with local domestic workers. They say that their work conditions are bad enough already, and the new competition is making things worse. At an informal meeting in the city, they shared their concerns.
These people from Uganda, they really mess us up. When you get work, you negotiate a good rate. When they come, they lower the rate. So when you go to ask for a job somewhere, you're told you're a Kenyan. I don't want you. I want a Ugandan. You Kenyans have high rates.
An abundance of girls looking for work means employers can easily take advantage of their situation. According to Kenya's Central Organization of Trade Unions, 83% of all domestic workers in Kenya are paid below the required minimum wage. Edith Morogo runs a shelter for girls who say they've been abused or mistreated by their employers.
I see domestic workers as a unique group of workers because of the conditions under which they work. They are confined. Many of them do not even have the permission to leave the employer's household. So they work in slavery-like conditions.
One of the latest arrivals at the shelter is Scovia. The same Scovia whose grandmother has been worrying about her in a home village in Uganda. She was brought in by police after being caught without documentation and is now being sent back to Uganda. The shelter has promised to help pay for her to go back to school.
I never imagined it would turn out this way, but it was God's plan. Because my parents both died and I'm an orphan, I dropped out of school because of lack of school fees. And now I have a chance to go back to school. So I'm happy for that. Very happy for that.
Esther is still in Nairobi and has found a job in a restaurant. But she has to walk the long distance there and back every day. Like many other women, she works from dawn to dusk for little pay. Surviving in the city is tough. Recently, she and her housemates were robbed of everything they had.
If I just sit here, no one will pay rent for me and there'll be no food. Better I go suffer, get money and return home. I want employers to know that we're people too. It's just that we don't have any money. You know, if we had money, wouldn't we be the same? Life would be good for us also. But I don't know why God allowed this, that some are poor and others are not.
Nancy Kachingora in Uganda. The United States and China are currently involved in an escalating and increasingly bitter trade war. Could a group of 17 chemical elements known as rare earths end up being China's trump card? Rare earths are used in high-tech consumer electronic elements and military equipment, and more than 80% of US imports between 2014 and 2017 came from China. So far, they've not been subject to any tariffs, but could the fact that President Xi went to a rare earth facility this week be an early indication they could be used as a weapon in that trade war? Anthony Lippman is a metals merchant who trades in rare earths.
Until very recently, they were forgotten for the very good reason that no one had many uses for them. But in our modern world, these rare earths, which are lanthanide metals, have become critical to things that we take for granted. Magnets that power the wind turbines and batteries in your electric vehicle.
And most of the mining of these rare earths is in China?
That's absolutely right. And Deng Xiaoping in his era said, we have rare earths, the Middle East has oil.
And they have become increasingly important, strategically important.
Yes, I mean, they are critical because if you need a permanent magnet, which is made out of neodymium, boron and iron, of which the neodymium is a rare earth, you cannot make that magnet without rare earths that essentially come from China. But the total world production of rare earths is no more than 150 or 200,000 tons. So it's a small market, but critical.
This week, President Xi has made this very pointed visit to a rare earth facility in China and does seem to be sending a message.
He is sending a message and he's preying on the existing latent American paranoia and hysteria to be vulnerable to other countries for critical materials.
Does the United States have rare earth stockpiles?
It does not.
So it would be very vulnerable if China cut off.
It would theoretically be vulnerable, but you have to then look at the geopolitics and the nature of China, and you have to ask yourself, with this huge landmass, is it feasible for the Central Communist Party to control all exports, or is it not? And my view as a metal merchant of 40 years is that the border is so wide and deep that materials will come out whatever.
Are we talking here about smuggling, or are we talking about corruption?
We're talking about a state that wishes to be a controlling state, but even the Chinese cannot control every part of their economy or their borders. The particular route for rare earths is through Vietnam, and I would expect those routes to become more frequented if China tried to withhold rare earths.
With officials maybe turning a blind eye.
Absolutely, or indeed colluding.
Metals merchant Anthony Lippman with Julian Marshall. Another tactic being used by China in the trade war is the use of propaganda songs. This one's been viewed hundreds of thousands of times since it first appeared on Chinese social media on Friday. It features strong criticism of the US and a vow to beat it out of its wits. I've been speaking to Kerry Allen from BBC Monitoring, who's been listening to it.
This song's called Trade War and it's been going viral on a Chinese social media app that's very similar to WhatsApp called WeChat. It's had hundreds of thousands of clicks and there's an accompanying music video which shows a fist, an animated fist set against exploding flames in a big circle, and you see video footage of Beijing appear, the army. It's set to an old propaganda song from the 1960s, so it's like a war chant and it's a signal to the US really about the ongoing Sino-US trade war. The lyrics are basically saying, you know, we'll smash this country. They're very, very strong lyrics. People have been seeing this on WeChat and they found it extremely powerful, very animated, and they're very enthusiastic about it.
There's a whole history of propaganda songs in China, isn't there? It's very much woven into the culture.
Yeah, there is, yeah. It's something that's particularly taken off in the last 5 years. So we've seen songs about events that previously might have been seen as quite boring, where guys in suits go and sit inside and have long negotiations and talks. So we've seen these kind of very unusual rap songs and propaganda songs about things like the five-year plan, the two sessions. There's been videos about relations with South Korea, for example, when it was working with the US to implement a controversial missile system that China completely disagreed with. China released a rap song in English, Korean and Chinese that was saying no to the THAAD.
Kerry Allen reporting. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition and the stories we included, drop us an email. We love hearing from you. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.